On today's program, a heartfelt interview, an odyssey of love in pink with Allison Miller. I'm Richard Brendan, and this is Journey's Fire. Before we get started with my conversation with Allison, here's a word from our sponsors.
Wellness is an active process of becoming more aware and making better choices that move you in the direction of a more successful life. Choices to eat well, move well, and think well enable your body to live well. When your spine is aligned properly, your brain and body are connected. Stillpoint Family Chiropractic is a family wellness center where we focus on your lifestyle and the impact it has on your spine, brain, and your life. Find us on Facebook at Stillpoint Family Chiropractic, or our phone number is 317-863-0365.
This WICR program is underwritten in part by Georgetown Natural Foods Market, located at 4375 Georgetown Road on Indy's west side. They carry organic produce and bulk body care products such as shampoo, lotion, soaps, and shower gel. Their kitchen serves soup, sandwiches, hot entrees, and carryout food. Plus, they have a juice bar. Georgetown Natural Foods Market, located at 4375 Georgetown Road on Indy's west side. Their website is georgetownmarket.com.
Richard Brendan, bringing love to life, is underwritten in part by Natural Awakenings magazine. Each month, Natural Awakenings takes a practical look at the latest natural approaches to nutrition, fitness, creative expression, personal growth, and sustainable living. The magazine also covers the products and services that support a healthy lifestyle. Natural Awakenings magazine is a free publication and can be found at most healthy lifestyle outlets. Their website is awakenindy.com.
Allison Miller's 24-year marriage was so passionate and fulfilling that after her husband's sudden death, she felt so much grief that it spurred her to do things that few, even she, could have imagined. It spawned a courage to face challenges that previously she flatly ruled out. She felt compelled to leap out of her comfort zone in an effort to get as far away from the pain as she could, and there on the road alone, she continues to feel the love and companionship of her handsome husband. I heard about Allison's story through a Facebook friend of mine. I've been following her journey myself and decided this story needs to be heard by so many more people, so I invited her on the program. She's traveling now with her daughter. The brakes went out of the vehicle, and so they happened to be in Winslow, Arizona. Yes, I know, the Eagles sang a song about that. Allison Miller, welcome to the program.
Thank you.
You have a very powerful and inspiring story that's really still unfolding, this adventure you've been on now for some time. But I suppose this all really began, this happily homeless as moonstruck adventure, years ago, back in the day when you met a guy and fell in love by the name of Chuck Deering.
Yes.
Why don't we start this interview there?
Okay.
And
ask away.
Where did you meet, and how did that first meeting go? When did you know you were in love? And then how soon after did you guys get married?
Oh, wow. That's taking me back. I don't have many people ask me about those parts of it. I was a single parent with three small children under the age of five when I was living in New Jersey with my mom. I'd moved there after my divorce. And so I was living in New Jersey, just going to school, trying to make something of my life, you know, for me and my kids. And I'd been there, I don't know, I guess maybe a few months. I don't even remember exactly. And there's a knock at the door one day, and I opened the door, and there's this gorgeous guy standing there wearing BDUs, and it was the old-style BDUs that are more green than anything. And so he was in uniform, had a mustache, and it was Chuck. And he was looking for someone to care for his daughter in the afternoons because he worked swing shift. And so he was looking, and she was about the, she was only a year older than my daughter, and he'd seen me down the street with my kids, and so he thought he'd come over and ask. And so I said, well, I can do that. And we were I don't know, not really much to each other, you know, just, you know, kind of a working type of thing. And then at some point along the way, what really made me start noticing him was that maybe a few months after that, you know, we'd talked about our stories, you know, his story, my story. Mm-hmm. And so a few months into it, I was walking back from the school one day. I dropped my daughter up at school, and I passed his house. And he was out front with his car and in the driveway, and he said, "Hey, can you come over here for a minute?" And I walked over, and he had a hatchback, and he lifted the hatchback of his car, and it was filled with groceries. And I, you know, "What are those?" And he said, "Well, you know, I went into work." He was active duty at the time. He said, "I went into the office, and I told everybody there that, you know, I know this woman down the road. She's a single parent, and she has three kids, and she's really, you know, doing everything she can to make it all work. So why don't we all just, let's just be generous and turn out our pockets and see how we can help her." And he collected a whole bunch of money, and he went to the commissary, and he bought a whole bunch of groceries.
Mm.
And it was food that I hadn't seen in a very long time, and
because
I was on welfare at the time.
Yeah.
And then he gave me a card, and I still have it to this day. He gave me a card that he'd bought and that everybody had signed in his office. And inside was the remainder of the money that he'd collected. And the kindness of that touched me so deeply because I'd come out of an abusive alcoholic relationship, my marriage, and it was just really hard, and I was just really angry at the world and at men and everything else. And that little act of kindness made me start looking at him as, you know, there's more here than meets the eye.
Yeah.
And it just kind of started going along. I guess it was, we got married in 1990.
Uh-huh.
And it was a second marriage for both of us, and mm-hmm. he brought his daughter, and I brought my three children.
Mm-hmm.
And Chuck just took them into his heart. My ex chose not to be involved in our kids' lives,
mm-hmm.
either through child support or seeing them or being a parent or anything else.
Mm-hmm.
And Chuck just stepped right in, and we used to joke later on in life that he'd always wanted to have a big family. He just never figured that that was a way that he was going to get it by having three stepchildren. But he never considered them his stepchildren, and my kids never considered him a stepdad. It was always he was their dad, and on both sides.
Yeah.
And he just jumped right in with all the, you know, with co-parenting with me and helping me raise them.
Yeah. And you were married 24 years.
Yes.
In your blog, even you referred to him as a handsome husband.
Yeah. You know why I did that?
Why?
Because when we went on the road in 2009, we sold everything and went on the road to get out of the rat race. I love to write, and so I started keeping a blog so that everybody, you know, family and friends could keep in touch with us. And Chuck just wanted to be retired, you know, and I was thinking, oh, no, I want to get followers. I want to connect with people. I want to do this and that. And he said, I just want to be retired. So I started calling him Handsome Husband, not only because I thought of him that way, but because I kind of, in a joking way, I wanted him to be able to maintain his anonymity.
Well, speaking of 2009, the adventure that you guys were on, this love affair marriage that you both shared, took a turn when you guys decided to sell your home in New Jersey and everything in it and decided to travel the country. Where did that decision come from?
Well, I guess most people, or a lot of people, when they, you know, the kids are grown and gone, and you just start thinking, okay, what do you want the rest of your life to look like? And Chuck and I never suffered from empty nest syndrome. We loved our kids to pieces, but we'd always maintained our, you know, ourselves, our couplehood, as first and foremost in our marriage, because having come from the marriages that we did, we knew that we needed to pay attention so that this marriage worked in every way.
Mm-hmm.
And so we knew we needed to nurture it. We needed to nurture each other. We needed to cherish each other.
Mm-hmm.
And that way our kids could have a very secure environment and a future with, you know, with us as an intact family.
Mm-hmm.
And so when they all left home, it's like we just celebrated. We thought, wow, all this time together now. And so we'd been talking off and on about, oh, wouldn't it be great to just travel the country? I mean, he'd traveled so much in the Air Force, and I'd traveled a lot because I was an Army brat. And so it was just kind of a fantasy thing, but also real, that, okay, let's just sell everything and go. I mean, who doesn't think about that, right?
Right.
And but then he retired from active duty, and he was working civil service, and the stress of the job, I thought daily he was going to have a heart attack. Mm. The morale was so low in the office, and there's just no leadership in the office. I guess that's the best way to put it. Mm-hmm. And so Chuck hung in there for 11 years, and I was running a nonprofit that I'd started in New Jersey. Mm-hmm. And he emailed me one day, and I still have the email, and the email said, "I think I can retire in 3 weeks. What do you say?" And I emailed him back, and I said, "Take all the terminal leave that you have and come home today, and we'll put the house on the market tomorrow. Let's go."
Mm.
And it didn't happen quite that fast, but it happened within a matter of months. Mm. It was right before the big crash in 2009.
Yeah, right.
And so we put our house on the market, and we ended up in a bidding war, mm-hmm. which was so weird. But so the people that we chose, because they ended up bidding the exact amount, so we said, okay, well, whoever is willing to move in here first, then that's the one that gets the house. And that happened May 29th. We did the house closing,
mm-hmm.
and we already had everything packed up into the truck
mm-hmm.
that we were going to save, because we thought, well, we'll just find another place to settle somewhere around the country. And so we were going to put it in storage while we went state shopping, as I called it. And we went home from the closing. The truck was parked right there in the driveway, and he got in the truck, and I got in the car, and we started heading west to Indiana, where his mom lived.
Yeah. He, during that trip, he discovered that he had cancer, which was treated in 2011. What kind of cancer was that?
It was sarcoma,
mm-hmm.
Which is a hyper-aggressive cancer, and we had been out in Oregon traveling,
mm-hmm.
and a dear friend of mine lived in New Jersey and had cancer and was dying, and we had planned to go back so I could see her, and we were going to give ourselves 3 weeks because we thought we had that amount of time. Mm-hmm. So we'd made reservations and everything else, and then I got a phone call from another friend, and she said, "Allison, you know, if you're going to see Rhoda, you need to come now." And the kind of guy that Chuck was, who just loved me so much, by the time I was off the phone to my friend and he had heard the conversation that was going on, he was already on the internet getting me a ticket. And he took me to the airport out there in Medford, Oregon, the next day,
mm-hmm.
and put me on the plane. And by the time I landed, I got a phone call, and my friend Rhoda had died while I was in the air.
Mm-hmm.
But Chuck was going to take that 3 weeks and just, you know, travel back, you know, the same route that we had planned.
Mm-hmm.
And the day that, after dropping me off at the airport in Oregon, he went back to the little place we'd rented, and there was a little lump underneath his wrist on the left-hand side, the inner wrist,
mm-hmm.
and it was kind of the size of a BB pellet. And he didn't think too much of it, just noticed it. And then by the time he got to New Jersey 3 weeks later, he already had an appointment with our primary physician, because the lump had grown quite aggressively and it was very large and getting larger, like from morning to night. And mm-hmm. we got him in to see the primary, who said, "I can't touch this. You need to go to a hand surgeon." And we went to the hand surgeon, and this is taking weeks, you know, for approval,
sure.
from insurance, and
sure.
it's growing, and the stress on my part is growing. And we got to the hand surgeon, and he said, "I can't touch this either. You need to see a specialist over in Philly." And Chuck overheard one of the nurses say the word cancer. And I was already thinking that. I had already had several deaths in my family from cancer.
Mm-hmm.
I was already, you know, hitting the panic button. And when he got out to the car, I asked him, you know, is it cancer? And he says, "Well, they're not sure." And I said, "It is. I mean, you know, what else can it be, right?"
Mm-hmm.
And so that started a long process of six surgeries, and between removing the tumor, we named it Wilson because it was so frightening in size, and we wanted to have a kind of an ease in talking about it,
yeah.
and to give people an easier way so they'd say, "Well, how's Wilson doing?" You know,
yeah.
rather than giving it the scary term of cancer,
yeah.
even while realizing, of course, what it was. But he went through an 11-hour surgery to remove the tumor.
Mm-hmm.
Prior to that, he was getting, they put him on radiation immediately. By the time we got to the specialist in Philadelphia, who was actually the one who had pioneered the method of treating this particular cancer,
mm-hmm.
He said, you need to go across the street immediately, now, and you need to get fitted for radiation. Chemo won't touch this. You need to get fitted for radiation, and we need to start it tomorrow.
Mm-hmm.
And so for 2 weeks, he received radiation once a day, and the tumor kept growing, and then it got ulcerous, and it was horrific. And the doctor said, because they couldn't operate on it until it had stopped growing.
Mm-hmm.
And so then the doctor said, well, we need to go Hiroshima on this. And so Chuck was set up for twice a day for 100% radiation dose,
mm-hmm.
and with 6 hours in between. And so he did that for 2 weeks, and it stopped the growth. And then they went in and they did the surgery, and then he had to have all the cosmetic surgeries to repair his arm, because they went up to the elbow,
yeah.
to look for boundaries. And then they had to graft a lot of skin and everything else from his right thigh.
Mm.
And so he had to do a lot of therapy. And he was he said no thanks to all of the they're going to send a nurse out and all of this to us. And he said, my wife can do everything that I need her that needs to be done, because she will do it with love. And
mm-hmm.
you know, that's exactly what it needs.
Mm-hmm.
And so this is all while we're staying at temporary places, people giving us places to stay and staying in hotel rooms and all of this, and trying to manage it. But we did. And every time in between, then he had to start going for CAT scans every 3 months and all
mm-hmm.
of that.
Mm-hmm.
And in between surgeries and in between CAT scans, we'd always have the car packed up, and we'd have an appointment by, say, 8 o'clock in the morning in Philly. And we would just leave from Philly and head west again.
Yeah.
Yeah, for as long
and,
as we could stay on the road.
And you did. But then
we
came
did.
March 27th, 2013. I believe you're in Southern California.
Yes.
And that's
yes.
when you discovered that his cancer had returned.
Yes. Yes, he'd been getting sick. And he had gotten a systemic fungal infection from, because his immune system was so beaten down by the radiation.
Mm-hmm.
So he'd gotten a systemic fungal infection, and he'd also injured himself in the first Gulf War, so he had a bad back. And so when he was having pain there, we thought, okay, it's his back problem or it's a kidney stone. And he was starting to cough, but that was also a symptom of the fungal infection.
Mm.
And there was, but there was different things happening, and we were starting to have the conversation of, okay, we need to go back to Arizona where two of our kids are. We need to settle in, get this taken care of, get your health better, and then we can go back out on the road. And I'd asked him twice, do you think the cancer has returned? And
mm-hmm.
he was, with complete assurance, he said, no, I'm sure it's not that.
Yeah.
Until March 27th.
Yeah. And upon hearing that news, he died about 4 weeks later, is that right?
Yes.
What was the date he died on?
He died April 21st, 2013. It was just, we had marked 5 years last Saturday.
Yeah. Yeah, I thought it was close to this taping of this
yes.
interview. Before he died, you promised him something.
Yeah.
What was that?
Well, we had a conversation, and the fact was I didn't have a house to return to.
Mm-hmm, right.
I knew from the moment he went into the hospital that, and the doctor said, there's a mass on your lungs, and I knew it was tumors, and I knew he was going to die,
mm-hmm.
not because I was being negative, but because I was being very real about it, and I just knew this one was going to kill him. And so my first response, even as with all the shock and devastation, was, I just want to surround him and immerse him with all of the love that he's given to all of us, and all the love that he's loved me with and mine to him. And so we just tried to create a beautiful space for him, including with conversation, you know, talking honestly about what was going to happen and that he was going to die. And so in one of our conversations, I told him, I'm going to continue traveling. I didn't know what else to do.
Mm-hmm.
I didn't want to go live with our kids. And Chuck and I had just spent our last 4 years on the road. I wanted to continue that.
Yeah.
I didn't know how or nothing. But so he said at that point, and I know that all of this was not hardwired in his brain, you know, hard thought out. Mm-hmm. But I knew he had something going in his brain when he said that he asked me to return to our favorite places and scatter his cremains. Mm. And he named four places for me.
Okay.
And I said, okay, I'll do that. Mm-hmm. I will do that. And I said, I'm going to paint my car pink so you can find me out on the road. And he said, well, I'll be looking for you. Mm. And in that same conversation, he'd said to me, black isn't your color. He said, don't mourn for me in black. Wear pink. Mm. I know he wanted some brightness for me.
Yeah.
And so he named the four places, but I knew, and I kind of only figured this out as I was going along, fulfilling that, I realized that that there were other places that I wanted to scatter his cremains, that he would like his cremains scattered, and that his thinking, whether formulated or not, was in being able to recognize those other places to scatter his cremains, I would have to keep my heart open.
Mm-hmm.
And I know that he hoped in keeping my heart open that I would be able to create a life for myself without him.
Yeah. But also by keeping your heart open, I can only imagine that your grief was so raw for so long.
Oh, God, yeah. I was devastated. It's like the minute he died at 11:21 on that April 21st, my entire world disintegrated and I couldn't remember. I had no memories. Like, I couldn't remember what we'd done or where we'd been. I couldn't remember what it felt like for him to put his arms around me or for him to kiss me or hold my hand. I just went blank. And just everything disappeared. Mm-hmm. Everything disappeared in him. And so part of being out on the road, in addition to the mission that he'd assigned me, which is what in the Air Force they give you a mission. And Chuck was, you know, he remembered that, and he knew that I was a woman who would need a mission.
Yeah.
And so I had to do it for me as much as him, but initially it was about him and honoring his last wishes. And mm-hmm. then it became, as I went out there on the road, and I'd never camped and I'd never towed, and I didn't have a clue. He'd been our long range planner. That's what he did in the Air Force, one of his jobs. And so he would map things out and do the routes, and he would, okay, where are we going to stay, and make reservations and fun things to go and explore and all these other things. And I knew I could do that, but I didn't know, like, I hadn't applied myself to it. Those muscles weren't working in my brain. And,
yeah.
And so when I set out, I was all the emotional components of it, and I didn't know how to do any of this the way he did it, and that was a huge thing on my brain. Like, you start, when you're grieving, you kind of fixate on weird and unusual things sometimes, mm-hmm. and I thought, I can't do this. My brain just isn't there, and my heart and my emotions, and I finally said to myself, and it was just in the couple months after, you know, so if you're saying this to Chuck, what would Chuck say to you? And he'd say, Allison, you don't have to do it the way I did it. You just have to do it the way you do it and make it work for you. And that was a great lift off
mm-hmm.
of me.
Mm-hmm.
And I still didn't know how to do it. And it's not only that I didn't know how to do it, I wasn't interested in doing it the way, you know, with making plans at like 2 weeks ahead of time and reservations, because that would mean I had to be there or
right.
lose the money.
Right.
And I didn't trust my brain. You know, the brain gets so fogged in grief. And I thought, you know, I just have to keep my heart open. I have to let my heart tell me where I need to go with this.
Mm.
And I knew that I couldn't do it the way Chuck and I did with staying at military bases in their lodgings or at hotels. Because
mm-hmm.
I thought, there is nothing more pathetic in my own mind than me, a grieving widow, sitting in some hotel room in the back of beyond wherever in this country, all by myself.
Yeah.
And I had worked in hospice. Actually, I was I facilitated grief support groups, and I knew the worst thing to do now is isolate yourself. That's what you want to do,
mm-hmm.
but that's the worst thing you can do.
Mm-hmm.
So I thought about what I'd told Chuck. Okay, I'm going to paint my car pink. And I thought, you know what? If I paint my car pink, and then my daughter told me, Ma, get a little trailer. buy a little trailer, you know, and you could live in that. And I thought, well, I've never towed anything. I don't know how to do any of that. Mm-hmm. But I thought, it's different. I can do it. And so I found a guy in Arizona who restored cars, Anthony Ortega, and I said, I need to have this color created. And I told him the love story that Chuck and I had, and I said, I need you to create a color pink for me. And he did. And when I went back to pick up my car, and my daughter, Rachel Grace, went with me, and Anthony handed me the paint can, and he'd named the color. And the color is named Chuck's Watching Over Me Pink. And he said, that way, Allison, you're not going to be out there on the road alone. Chuck will be, he'll be right with you. And so I carry the formula with me. And when I bought my trailer a few months later, everything that's pink on it now because it's a little tab teardrop, and it was kind of a yellow-orange color. Mm-hmm. And I had them paint it pink. And I knew I had to draw people to me so I wouldn't be isolated. I knew they would ask me why all this pink, and I'd be able to share my story, which is a crucial part of getting through your grief. Mm. And I knew that it would make me accountable. If I'm driving this pink car and this pink trailer around, people are going to start noticing and paying attention. And then if I don't show up someday, they're going to hold me accountable, and they're going to reach out to me and say, where are you? Mm-hmm. And that's exactly what happened.
And along the way, you've created a blog that more and more people are reading.
Yes. I have, you know, it comes up on the timeline in Facebook, and it came up a few days ago that where I posted on the Happily Homeless's Moonstruck page that, you know, we've been posting about our travels, Chuck and I have, but now this is going to be a way to stay in touch to let you know what's going on here in hospice.
Yeah.
And so then when I picked up my writing again for my blog, it became about not only navigating the geographical terrain as I found my way and figured out how to tow and camp and just do all of this, it also became about navigating the emotional terrain of widowhood and being a woman out on the road alone. Mm-hmm. And so that's, have you been, it's all, I have a, I, so then I made a website, happilyhomelessesmoonstruck.com, and then my daughter, thank goodness for younger people who know how to do all the technology, and she helped set me up and put links to my blog and my Facebook page and everything else on the website.
What are some of the biggest takeaways that people have when they notice you, they want to have a conversation with you? What are they most intrigued about?
I think it's a combination. Sometimes, honestly, it's, wow, you're a woman alone out here on the road.
Yeah.
By yourself.
Yeah.
And which I thought that was, I knew there had to be others out here doing this also, women and widows. And I couldn't possibly be the only one, even though I wasn't meeting any of them. But so many people said, wow, you know, you're out here alone and you've just been widowed. And people have odd ideas, and I did too, about what widows look like and what they do and don't do. and so because I knew there had to be others out here, I started a Facebook group called Road Widows, Road Warriors. Hmm. And I thought, okay, where are you? Where are you? Because we need to connect with each other, and I want to connect with you. And there are now almost 800 women in the group.
Oh, that's wonderful.
And they're all out here part-time, full-time, doing the same thing. And so that kind of, you know, people saying that to me as I was out on the road, kind of, it started me searching. Okay, there's others out here. But I got so much support from, like, the military community. I would oftentimes, and still do, stay at military FAM camps. You know, there are RV sites. And along the way, I guess maybe about the second year, because Chuck's cremains and his flag ride shotgun with me, and the jacket from his BDUs that he was wearing the day that we met. And so I started contacting, I would look up on the whatever base I was going to be, I'd look for their public affairs office, mm-hmm. and I would just find a name, mm-hmm. and I'd email that person mm-hmm. in public affairs, and I'd introduce myself and say, this is who I am, this is what I'm doing, this is my odyssey of love, and I'm not expecting you to do anything with the story, but I do think it is very, very important that somebody, at least one person on your base, knows that a veteran is passing through your base on his final travels.
Mm-hmm.
And every so often, they would, I'd get a response. And in Biloxi, Mississippi, at Keesler Air Base, I got a response from a tech sergeant named Alex Mosnes, and she's the most wonderful woman, and we are good friends. We have become good friends over the years. She wrote a story about my odyssey of love, and it kind of got past, went up the channels in the Air Force,
mm-hmm.
and it eventually, the story that that Alex wrote ended up being on the Air Force Worldwide Network. And the beautiful part about that was in I started getting emails from active duty around the world and from veterans who read the story, just thanking me for doing this for my veteran.
Yeah, yeah.
People are touched when they hear the story. They want to know more is what it comes down to.
Oh, I would imagine. I want to ask you, undoubtedly there are listeners right now who have lost a loved one, perhaps even a spouse. What are you, Allison, learning, I-N-G, what are you learning about grief and working through grief?
Well, what I've learned is that I must have a strong voice because I must give myself the space and allow myself to grieve in my way, because there's an awful lot of lip service given to that. And people will say, oh, there's no timeline for grief, but then they're kind of looking at you when, okay, 6 months, a year, and then, you hit the third year mark. There's not much space given for that. And whatever the relationship was that you're grieving, you as a griever need to be strong enough to say, thank you for your opinion. I'm good over here. What I finally learned how to do was say to people, you know what? I don't need you to tell me how to grieve.
Mm-hmm.
I don't need you to tell me anything about my grief. What I need from you are practical suggestions about how to travel, how to make money, how to live like daily life.
Yeah, yeah.
Because my brain's not, I'm just not super engaged in that part right now.
Mm-hmm.
So you help me with that part. You leave my grief to me.
Mm-hmm.
And I wasn't strong. It took me a long time to get strong enough to be able to say that
mm-hmm.
and to claim my space. It's, life goes on. We all know that. And daily life, people go on with their lives. But there's an awful lot of grief shaming out there.
Yeah.
And that is what I am determined to change. And there are people that I have connected with who are also working to change all of that.
Mm.
Because it's not rocket science. Stop with the words. Stop with all the cliches that do nothing except make us doubt ourselves.
Mm-hmm.
I thought I was crazy, and now... you're kind of convincing me I am, and I don't know where to go from here.
Yeah.
Yeah. And so, that the language has to change, and really it is so simple.
Mm-hmm.
Don't say anything. Sit and be with.
Mm-hmm. Well, and because of the 24 years you had with this dear man, as a matter of fact, I notice in your emails to me when we've emailed back and forth setting up this interview, you have a salutation, you have your name, and underneath that you say, proud widow of Chuck D.
Yeah.
So that love was deep and it was rich. You've now been on your own, although I know he's always with you, but you've been on your own physically for 5 years. So
yeah.
I want to ask you, what are you learning about love?
I have learned... Well, for one thing, what I can say is that I have spent 5 years trying to find a connection to Chuck, because
mm-hmm.
when he died that night 5 years ago, everything really, I felt like everything disappeared. I have not felt that emotional connection to him.
Mm-hmm.
I've spent 5 years desperate to find it, and people would say, well, Chuck's with you. But what is that to me? Like,
mm-hmm.
that's just words to me. If I'm not experiencing it, then it doesn't mean anything. And also, it would make me think, well, what's wrong with me if I'm not feeling his love around me? And you, the general you, know it's there, but I'm the one that had the closest relationship with him.
Yes.
So that means that there's somehow I'm defective in this
mm-hmm.
or missing something.
Mm-hmm.
So what I've learned, though, is that there is so much love out in the world. And we don't hear about it. you know, in the news and, you know, just like generally speaking. And I'm here to tell you, I have connected, gotten hugs, given hugs from thousands of people at this point. And what happened recently was, and I was staying with my daughter and her fiancé up in Peoria, Arizona. And so I was, you know, some time off the road, and I could just kind of be and not have to think about the next thing and the next thing. So what I ended up doing was taking two courses, one from, there's a woman in Illinois named Sarah Nannan. She wrote a book called Grief Unveiled, and she is a military widow. Her husband was a Thunderbird pilot, and she wrote this amazing book, and then she offered this course. It was a 10-week course. It was online with once-a-week Zoom meetings, you know, video meetings.
Yes, yes.
And then a week after I'd started that one, Christina Rasmussen, who wrote the book Second First, and these are both women who are very intent on changing the language and how we look at grief. Christina Rasmussen, I'd met her several years ago. She contacted me. She said, look, I have this life reentry course starting online. I have a scholarship available. Would you be interested? And I said, yes, absolutely. So I took these two courses about, and it's about looking at all of us, you know, all of what makes us up and all of this grief and looking beyond the grief to what else is adding to this. And what they both helped me do, Christina's course helped me find what she calls my thriver self, the strong part that is there that maybe the flame has flickered a lot and just can't quite locate it. But through meditations and the work she had us do, I found that thriver self, which is the self that lives beyond this grief. And then with Sarah Nannan, hers wrapped up with a retreat in Illinois, and I just went to it a few weeks ago with a few other widow sisters. And it was just 3 days of guided meditations and body movement and yoga and restoration and talking about self-limiting talk. And what I loved about her course was that she just kind of whispers, and it's almost humorous that this is, and she'll say, this is about more than your dead husband. And I have a very dark sense of humor, and so that absolutely appealed to me. And but what it is, it's about our coping mechanisms and where did they come from, and so what we can, how we can separate them. And I guess the biggest part of all of it was that both Christina and Sarah, what they emphasize is that it's not an either or. You don't have to leave your story and your love story and this person behind, which is what so much of our culture tells us, you know, get on with it and be happy and all this other baloney.
Right.
You know, they say you can bring them with you and you can be this beautiful, passionate, fully engaged in life person. And you'd think that sounds obvious to anybody, but I know for me personally, I spent so much time in these past years fighting against all of that language. Well, you know, a counselor had told me, you need to write a goodbye letter to Chuck. And it's like, I knew that didn't feel right, and I'm not writing a goodbye letter to him. Actually, what I need to do is I need to bring him more in. I need to remember. And then and Sarah would lead us on exercises for helping with all of that. You know, I was fighting against people saying, well, maybe you're depressed and you need medication. There is an appropriate time and place for people, and that is a personal choice. I knew for me, and I told the counselor, I don't think this is a thing for medication. This is my soul. I need to do some soul work. And if I take medications, my feeling is, my gut feeling, is that it will impede the work that I need to do to get to the other side. And Sarah also, in the first meditation on Friday morning, when I was at the retreat, the very first meditation that she guided us through, I had this, I can't say I saw Chuck. I can't say I necessarily felt him. I just knew he was there and I saw him, but weird language, I don't know how to explain it. What I felt was his love pouring, showering onto me. It was the first time I felt connected to him in 5 years, where I knew. And I spent a lot of the weekend just in tears because of it, because every meditation that I went through, he was there, that love was there. And I knew that his heart was just breaking with joy for me, because had done this for myself.
Mm-hmm.
So that, because Sarah, she told us what she whispers to other widows now when she sees them after they've suffered the death of their loved one. She'll just kind of just whisper very gently, just put this in your pocket for right now. I just want you to know there is sweetness on the other side of this. And she's just so gentle, and Christina is so inspiring. And those two women, through their courses that I signed up for, they brought me to this place where I am so, as I started out yesterday, I feel like the most powerful woman in the world, because I know that Chuck's love is all around me. He is right with me. And there is so much love around me. And it is coming from me, and I am receiving it. And it is the only thing I trust anymore. And it's from my heart. I don't even think about my brain anymore. It has led me into places where, you know, it makes me worry,
yes,
and stress,
yes,
and all of that.
Yes.
I do legwork about stuff, like I am here with, you know, the brakes going all the hell and back again.
Uh-huh.
I do the legwork. But even as I'm here in this little town in Winslow, Arizona, and I have to get to Arkansas, and I don't have the money to pay for this, and all of this stuff that, like, could have stressed me out to the max.
Yes.
What I know is that all of the energy here, I have trusted before that if I need to turn left, I go left. Or if I get stuck somewhere, there's somebody I have to meet or mm-hmm. who needs to meet me.
Mm-hmm.
Something needs to happen here.
Mm-hmm.
And so as I'm here with my daughter in this little town of Winslow, Arizona, The garage where I am, it's a family-owned. They are treating me like gold. They hooked me up to electricity. They even put a little mat outside my little rig, Pink Magic, so that I wouldn't drag grease into inside. And there's something happening here. I don't know what. I don't know any of the logistics of this,
mm-hmm.
but I'm just focusing on the love.
That's
the biggest thing that I've learned about any of this, and I've accepted it along the way.
Yeah.
Just love, just love, just love, just love.
Yeah. And so, Allison, where does your odyssey of love go from here?
Well, in the practical form, it's taken me to Arkansas, outside of Eureka Springs, where I have I'm returning for the second year to be a work camper,
mm-hmm.
which is a seasonal temporary job at an opera camp, and I was there last year, and I'm the groundskeeper there. So I ride a tractor, and I plant flowers. and when I go this year, because of what I know, because I know that I am so powerful because of all the love that I'm carrying with me from Chuck and the love of everybody. And I don't mean to sound cheesy like this, but, like, I am heartfelt.
Yeah.
I'm not bypassing anything. It's like, yes, love is this strong.
Mm-hmm.
And so when I go to the opera camp this year, mm-hmm. I am... My setup with my trailer is going to be absolutely beautiful, and it's going to reflect some of the meditations I did when at the retreat weekend I did with Sarah. Because what I envisioned in one of them was that this grief and this devastation of living without Chuck, it was like this heavy, heavy cloak that was waterlogged from so many storms and dragging in the mud and weighing me down. And in one of the meditations, after I'd seen, you know, and felt all of Chuck's love showering on me and his joy for me, what I pictured was that cloak falling away and just kind of becoming this basket on my arm that is filled with these most beautiful flowers. And that's how I'm carrying my grief now, very gently and tenderly and lovingly on my arm instead of it dragging me down.
Mm.
And so when I set up my rig at the opera camp, I'm going to have flowers everywhere. Flowers are now a part of all of this.
Yes. Yes. I like that.
And then I'm just going to go out and meet people. And I'm going to connect with them, and I'm going to hug them. And I'm going to say, yes, you can have a love story. Yes, you can be a widow, and we will walk with you through it. And you can still go and do this. You can buy a trailer. You could go out on the road. You can make totally outlandish decisions.
Mm-hmm.
You don't even have to be widowed to do this. You can say, I want to get out of the rat race. And sell everything and just go.
Mm-hmm.
And my first book is just about ready for publication. And I'm going to start what I call doing Odyssey phone calls, which is one-on-one phone calls with people to just to support them through making these really big decisions, whether you're widowed or not. It's like all the stuff that I've done since the day Chuck and I left New Jersey in 2009. Mm. I know stuff I don't even know I know. And I do know a lot of other things. And I know that all of this is possible, and you just have to have love with you. And it'll happen, and you can make it happen. And that is the rest of my life, living our love story, honoring Chuck's legacy, and connecting with people all around the country in my pink car and my pink trailer, and letting them know that love is bigger than anything else.
My listeners can learn more about you and also follow your odyssey on your blog by visiting your website. Can you please share your web address?
Yes, the web address is happilyhomelessismoonstruck.com.
I love that.
And on that is a link to my Facebook page where mm-hmm. I post daily, mm-hmm. and I usually blog about weekly. And now I also write, this was something else that I just was able to make happen because I said, yes, I'm going to do this. I also write for an organ once weekly. I write a blog called Widow's Voice, and it's for a nonprofit called Soaring Spirits International, and they support widows and widowers around the world. And now I'm also writing for Christina Rasmussen's website, Second First. Mm. So I write for them weekly. So I'm getting my... I just share whatever experience I have for all of this.
Yeah.
And I'm just going to keep doing it, you know?
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
So...
Well, Allison, it's been a joy and a delight to have you on the program today. Thank you for sharing your journey with us today.
Oh, thank you so much. It's an honor. It is an honor to carry this, you know? It is. I'm strong enough to carry it, and I didn't know that I was, but I'm feisty enough to carry it without even realizing I was strong enough for it. And now it's all about the love, nothing but love, and my pink car, my pink trailer are kind of, they just announce it all, and then I just and then it's me and I carry the rest of it.
Once again, her website is happilyhomelessismoonstruck.com. And now here's our newest Wellness Minute from Dr. Mary Grace Pinella.
Stopping to rest. There is a fabulous new book out by Karen Brody called Daring to Rest. The book is mainly directed at women. You know the type, superwoman, mom, coworker, all-around superhero. The premise of the book is that we never really stop to rest. It's a great conversation and one that needs to be had by all people, not just women. In this 140-character soundbite world we find ourselves in, there is no scheduled time for rest. Right, that's supposed to happen when we collapse in bed at night. And how many people do you know that have trouble sleeping? Oh, wait, are you one of them? Yeah, you have lots of company in this area. One look at the reality of a flu epidemic tells you that we are not resting. Rest is when your system gets a reboot. The digestive system, the immune system, and even the repair and rebuild functions are all supposed to happen when we rest. Interestingly, rest is directed by the parasympathetic portion of your nervous system. Most of the time, this system is suppressed by our stress-handling, sympathetic nervous system. One way to balance these systems is your chiropractic adjustment. So I am going to suggest that you take a look at Karen's book, Daring to Rest, and commit to resting. Her 40-day program will leave you healthier and more rested.
In closing this program, here's an encore segment of an interview I did with the great social change artist, Jean Houston.
And what I have found is that all over the world, in my work with leadership, too many of the problems in society today stem in part from leadership that is ill-prepared to deal with a world as complex as ours. I mean, other times in history thought they were it. They're wrong. This is it. This mm-hmm. is the most important time in human history. And people have been prepared to deal with the world, to be white males of the year 1926. And I find this in virtually every country that I've been in. Leaders living out of a field of awareness that is limited, that's limiting in their ability to deal with the world as it is today. And I find that worldwide, societies are asking for new kind of leaders, in preparation of new kind of people who essentially, it's as if their inner space, mm-hmm. their inner capacities are equal to the immense complexity of their outer world.
Mm-hmm.
And so I began to create programs that would begin to train leaders, and then suddenly I found myself joining up with the United Nations Development Program and becoming a senior consultant there to begin to create these kinds of programs. So I've been in, oh good Lord, in the last few very recent times, I've worked with the leadership of Albania, the Eastern Caribbean, the island states there, Kenya, with delegations from Tanzania, Uganda. I've just sent some of my teams to Nepal, and in a couple of months I'll be in both Australia and the Philippines. And this gives you an idea of what my life is like, because we find that you know, as I've also worked with two United States presidents and three first ladies, and some of their similar forms in other countries. Mm-hmm. But we find at every level, people are striving to have perspective, depth, a sense of purpose, a sense of there must be another history for this world at this time. I sometimes think of this world as God's school. You know,
yeah.
Here we are, you know, a planet in a little sun at the outer wing of a galaxy, and not in the center where all, you know, the stars are close up. And it's as if this, it's like the Skunk Works. We're at the outer edge. This is the experimental lab where we're allowed to run through every foolishness and glory imaginable in order to really learn what it is to be a God seed, to be one who has the capacity to create new forms, perhaps planets, perhaps beings, perhaps more likely social structures. And so I think that this is the critical time when we're moving from where we were to where we can be. I've spent a lifetime studying the human potential, and we discover that most people, given opportunity, given training, can learn to think and be and use so much more of themselves in ways that hitherto would have seemed more mythic than real. We're in mythic times. We are missing links. So in this work of seeing how people can learn to think in multiple ways, we tap into the tremendous resources of their own creativity that lie just beneath the surface crust of consciousness, tap into the great stories and mythic journeys that each one of us contains, tap into the matrix of becoming, which is the spiritual yearning. If you learn to do this, and we really offer state-of-the-art strategies to do these things, and then apply it to social problems, oh, what a difference it makes, and what a difference it's making now as we're working all over the world.
You write in The Possible Human that nothing is more urgent today than our need to overcome archaic constraints of tribalism, nationalism, and ecological mayhem.
That's right.
Speak to that as far as
do. This is the great either-or of history. Mm-hmm. Either we really do it in the next few generations or we can forget about it. I've been traveling over the earth for a very long time, and I remember some decades ago, I would fly over Africa and look like Africa. You fly over Africa now, and the sub-Sahara desert has expanded in all directions. You fly over North Dakota, and you see the clay, you know, just coming up out of the earth. You see the ravaging of the forest, the loss of one species every 25 minutes. Every 25 minutes, another species is lost. We are earth beings. And when we forget our continuity with the earth, then we have lost not only the earth, we've lost our own souls. I mean, the level of problems is so great that it is as if we are being challenged to the very roots of our humanity in ways we never have before. So what I'm trying to do, Richard, is create a whole new profession. In fact, I've done so. And I've got, as I say, I have my troops deployed all over the world now. not troops, quite the opposite. Harmonious, compassionate, creative people. But also to try to help people become all that they can be. Because, to begin to live out, what is it T.S. Eliot said, redeem the time, redeem the unread vision of the higher dream. The unread vision, the codes, the capacities that we all contain within us, so that we can begin to become adequate stewards of this, the most critical time in human history.
Yeah.
You know, I've never met a stupid child. I've met incredibly stupid systems of education that demean and diminish. You put art back as central to the curriculum, where a child is learning spelling or history by incarnating it, by dramatizing it, learning fractions by weaving. I mean, you begin to bring the arts as a weave into the curriculum. Children don't fail. We helped create 50,000 new schools in Bangladesh based on putting the art and the culture back in the curriculum. I mean, there's just so many things that can be done. Well, the state of the art is very high. State of application is not. I am trying to extend both the art and the application all over the world.
It speaks about awareness. It reminds me of something Hafiz once wrote. He said, "What is this precious love and laughter budding in our hearts? It's the glorious sound of a soul waking up." That's what I'm hearing you say. Souls need to wake up.
Well, it's wake-up time. You know, in the Gnostic Gospel of St. Thomas, Jesus, who's rather eccentric in that Gospel, he says, "I came into this world, and I found you were all drunk. I'm here to wake you up out of your drunkenness." And I think that especially, you know, in the last, 20, 30, 40 years, the drunkenness, the lostness, the sleepiness of materialism. And whenever you have that level of materialism, you lose a sense of imagination. You lose a sense of the passion for the possible.
Mm-hmm.
And yet so many people feel the hound of heaven going, "Roof, roof, 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 roof," you know, at the heels in the morning. Wake up, get up, get on with it, get on with it. And so this is what we're trying to do. I'm trying to help people expand their vision, their courage, so they can serve their families, their communities. I'm helping them to try to awaken up, not just to the many different capacities they have, but the many cultures in their own life. I'm trying to help them wake up to forgotten capabilities, to remember and learn new forms for society, to become an authentic agent of change, and to become a leader in this chaotic and complex time.
Mm-hmm. Where did you come up with the term social artistry?
I have no idea. I have no idea. It may have, you know, Margaret Mead, the great anthropologist, lived with us the last 6 years of her life. And we used to have a lot of talks about these kinds of things. You know, she would say, "Never doubt that a small group of thoughtful, committed citizens can change the world. Indeed, it is the only thing that ever has." And so she began to bring me into these small groups.
Mm-hmm.
And one of the groups was the Tarrytown group. And it was Margaret and Bob Schwartz and myself. And then we would invite it was generally once a month, sometimes it was twice a month, and this went on for about 3-4 years. And every month we would invite somebody to help us, you know, a major thinker like Schumacher. And we would deal with world problems. And she would get me up to task. She said, "Jean, I need a 30-page paper on stress by the end of this week." "Yes, ma'am." And I'd go and I'd somehow, you know, she made these demands, so you had to respond. And so we would work on world problems. And then she would call up whoever was the president of the United States at the time at the end of the weekend. "No, Jimmy, what you have to do is..." So when I was about 30 years old, I felt as if I was running the world. So, you know, between all the conversations that we have, I'm sure somewhere along the line, that's where I probably dropped up in the term social artist. Because, you know, what is an artist? An artist is a person who has a kind of passion and focus and commitment and imagination and insight. And what we're trying to do is to help people gain that same kind of artistry, but to apply it to social problems, to the issues of today.
That was a segment of a conversation I had with the great best-selling author Jean Houston. My special guest today, though, is Alison Miller. And do check out what she's all about. Her website is happilyhomelessismoonstruck.com. And that's today's program. Our website is richardbrendan.org, a reminder that all shows are podcast on that site. And so for engineer Aaron Duvall and production coordinator Angel Richardson, I'm Richard Brendan. We're bringing love to life, one broadcast at a time.